Hello. Welcome to the Dark Beacon. Here, fear thrives. And the damned dance. If horror is your cup of tea, you're in the right place. Let's begin.
Forever's whenever, everything always. Some days he wakes with the vague idea that his name begins with W. Walter? Or Winston, maybe. Today, however, he awoke with the sense that his name might perhaps begin with H. Harry. Or Henry. This morning, H feels comfortable. H feels all right. The truth is, he doesn't know his own name. He feels that at some point in the distant past he may have known it, but if he ever did, the memory is now long lost. Old Miguel believes that in a few years' time there will be no more names at all. H doesn't believe, or doesn't want to believe, that this is true. Having a name is a quintessential aspect of the human experience, no? It's all right for old Miguel. He does know his own name. That's one of the advantages of having a wife. Through a spouse, one's identity might feel more solid, more real. H doesn't have a wife. Therefore, he has no external point of reference to validate or confirm the accuracy of one name over another. So every morning, he makes a choice. And this morning, H feels all right. He is on one of the countless electric shuttle buses that ferries workers from one of the myriad accommodation blocks to the factories. It glides with such little sound that it seems to float over the pristine tarmac with a disquieting, dreamlike quality. The only noise it utters is a gentle hum that sounds somehow sentient. In an indecipherable tongue, it mutters secret conversations with the environment through which it moves. The road is a flawless black silk ribbon. At precise angles of 45 or 90 degrees, or plumb line straight, it dissects vast rolling grass verges whose undulations in terms of ups and downs are unnaturally even. The grass is of immaculate uniform length. It is a spotless carpet of avocado green. No dry patches, no browning. Along the verges, keeping an indifferent vigil, spruce trees stand. They are neat and identical in the greenness of their hue, their height, the density of their foliage. Between each tree and the next is an expanse of precisely 6.5 metres. Above, inscrutable and ceaseless, the sky is a ceiling of bright, whitish-grey. It is a never-ending diaphanous abstraction, insistent and undeniable like a nauseating ache behind the eye. This isn't the real outside, H thinks. This is the company's version of outside. The company has taken great lengths to manufacture, manage and manicure every millimetre of the gargantuan mega-complex to try and create the sense that everything here is at one with nature. The grass verges, the peculiarly equidistant and identical trees, they play their part in this charade because they are owned by the company. But the company doesn't own the sky. And H thinks the sky here is always scowling. Of course, these kinds of thoughts are very dangerous and should never be spoken aloud. Of this, H is very well aware. Therefore, he will never voice such ideas, not even to himself. H is a crooked, thin man, angular like hinges. He wears tatty and faded company overalls of a drab pale blue that persistently cause an unresolvable itchiness that chafes against him on levels deeper than the skin. He thinks he might be hungry, but isn't sure he wants to eat. Like his name, he often finds that he can't recall what he ate for dinner the night before. Company rations are ambiguous, both in terms of nutritional value and actual identity. He tries hard to remember, uncertain if he ate at all. A vague sense of texture comes to mind, something soft and fibrous, perhaps synthetic broccoli stems. There was something sloppy and viscous too, hard to swallow, despite its wetness. Maybe porridge? H doesn't remember waking up this morning, nor does he recall getting onto the shuttle bus. Is his memory falling apart? It's a question he asks himself more and more frequently these days, or perhaps the instances of his waking and catching the bus are so commonplace, so banal, and so embedded into the routine of his existence that they fail to register as significant enough to be stored in the mind. He wonders if others experience similar difficulties remembering their morning routine, about calling to mind last night's meal, about the worrying state of their memory. He glances furtively at the other workers on the bus. He wants to look at them, but doesn't wish to be seen doing so. Every one of them is dressed in the same tired, bland overalls. They stare blankly ahead, or out of the windows, at the manufactured version of nature out there. Nobody talks. "I don't recognize any of these people," H thinks. But at least he is employed. Because employment is privilege, work is freedom. Unlike the ambiguity of his birth name, his company identifier code, or CIC, Antler Sunset Wicker, is burnt into his mind as if branded there. Having a CIC means he is a worker. He has a job, a wage. He really is very privileged indeed, and that's something he'll never forget. The gigantic building that looms ahead is PPD_6, Packaging and Pre-Dispatch Factory 6. In this zone there are 8 such sites, each as massive as the next. Working in this place is all H has ever known, and yet he never ceases to be staggered by the colossal size of it. He feels the kind of terrified awe he imagines one might experience when standing before an indifferent god of limitless and terrible power. The shadow cast by Factory 6 stretches so far down the road that when the shuttle bus enters its gloom, it will still be several minutes before the vehicle reaches the building itself. It makes H feel a little dizzy, the scale of it. Beyond the 8 PPD sites, there are the other complexes in the zone to consider. Research and development, regional dispatch, international dispatch, print manufacturing, product quality control, education and outreach, the central executive, disposal and waste management, vehicle maintenance, structural engineering, quantum computing operation and oversight, aviation and overseas, finance, legal and human resources, logistics, military and space operations, internal security, and dark ops. This is just one of several such zones. The company is an incomprehensibly vast, living, breathing and gargantuan organism deep inside which H is but a tiny and insignificant submicroscopic speck. Moving through, unnoticed. It is too much for him to contemplate. The shuttle bus begins to slow, which triggers in H the customary quickening of the pulse, the tightening in the chest, the shortness of breath, the disembodied sense of lightness, as if his spirit is trying to escape the confines of his body via the top of his scalp. These feelings are as natural to him as the heaviness of one's eyelids before sleep. They are the rising sense of dread signifying that soon he will arrive at work. In twos or threes, at each employee gate, workers disembark the shuttle bus. Soon they will reach H's gate, and in physiological response, his inner turmoil will intensify. He is not the only one that has grown used to this singular kind of misery. He sees it in the terse, fixed gazes of his colleagues as they alight. It is in the scrunched knots of their shoulders, in the way their fingers distractedly drum against the handrails on the seat in front or above. Eyelids spasmodically twitch, hands clench and unclench. Part of him wishes to gently tap one of his co-workers on the shoulders and ask if they are all right, if everything is okay, but he knows they would just say, "Yes," and then hurriedly look away, because that's what he would do. That's what everyone would do. With a hydraulic hiss and subsequent soft mechanical whine, the shuttle bus comes to a sudden and unexpected halt. They have not yet reached the gate through which H will enter Factory 6, and this is not normal because his gate is next, so why have they stopped? With a pinching sensation in his chest, H's pulse quickens further still. He sits up in his seat and intently stares ahead, trying to see what has caused the sudden stop. His thin fingers take a tight grip of the handbar of the seat in front. Some of the other passengers adopt a semi-standing position to aid their view of the road ahead. They see that outside gate 4, there are parked two internal security force vehicles, squat, mean, and powerful looking. Between them is parked a company ambulance, and silently its lights throb and flash, bathing the whole area in an epileptic and alien bright blue. Two armed SF guards are overlooking the scene. They are clad all in black, with chest armour and riot helmets that protect and obscure the entirety of their heads and faces. They are heavily armed, each wielding an assault rifle, a sidearm, a non-lethal shock charge pommel, a spring cosh, as well as two cans of anti-assailant spray, standard security personnel gear. The shuttle bus is 70 yards from the scene. The taller of the two SF guards, the one whose palm-up, outstretched arm gesture had brought about the vehicle's sudden braking, takes a few steps and lowers his arm. He grabs a radio device from his belt and raises it to his mouth. He presses a button on the device which connects him directly to the intercom system aboard the bus.
"All employees for gate 4. That's all employees for gate 4. Disembark the vehicle now. Move to the wall and form an orderly line."
Without a word, without a murmur, five workers, including H, leave the bus and step into the heavy shadow of the gigantic building. Hands clenched, jaws tight, they listen in silence. The tall guard, who seems to hold more authority than his colleague, with a disconnected voice, muffled by the solidity of the riot helmet, speaks.
"Don't be alarmed. You will be in your workstation shortly. You will just be entering in an organised and controlled manner. There has been an incident,"
he says. An unspoken ripple of disquiet passes through the employees, who have obediently formed a line, H at the rear. One by one, the employees move toward the shorter of the two guards, who holds up a handheld biometric reader and scans their retinas in turn. Positively identified, each worker is offered a curt "thank you" before they move on through the huge entryway of gate 4. It is H's turn to step forward, but he awaits the glance from the guard before moving. When his eyes are scanned, the biometric reader offers a short, shrill bleep. The guard looks towards his taller colleague and nods. The tall guard steps forward, a looming, immovable bulk.
"ASW 35.
It is more a statement than a question. H nods. Before anything else is said, two company medics emerge from Gate 4's huge doorway. They are dressed in anti-infection suits. Between them they wheel a stretcher, atop which, beneath a heavy, sterile sheet, is a heaped mass. H watches on, his heart thumping heavily in his increasingly tightening ribcage.
ASW-35?
Repeats the tall guard.
There has been a situation in your workstation.
H hears this now as if from a distance. He can't stop watching that stretcher with its squeaking wheels and rattling bars. With a jolt, its front wheels lurch over the curb edge and the stretcher bounces. A forearm and hand fall forth from under the covering. H feels lightheaded. What happened? He hears himself mutter as a wave of dizziness swims through his head.
A worker passed away,
the imposing SF guard answers with his muffled, matter-of-fact tone.
Looks to be natural causes. There will be tests.
The two medics have pushed the stretcher into the back of the ambulance. They close the doors, move to the front of the vehicle.
He was only a few minutes away from the end of his shift, the poor bugger,
the shorter guard offers. It is the first thing he has said.
Your workstation is being disinfected,
says the taller man. Disinfected? Asks H, his voice sounding jittery and light.
Standard super virus protocol. Lucky you,
the shorter man chuckles.
You get an additional paid break, fully authorised while you wait. We'll accompany you to the break room, ASW-35. Once your station is fit for work, you will be released to begin your shift. Clear?
The tall man begins moving towards gate 4 without waiting to hear H's acknowledgement. H nods anyway, fighting off another wave of nauseating dizziness. He begins to follow the guard but finds his feet are leaden. He stumbles, almost falls. The shorter guard, with surprising agility, catches him.
Careful there,
he chuckles.
Don't want another one for the back of the van, eh?
H mumbles, thanks, as he rights himself. The ambulance pulls off and purrs away along a southbound road towards the forever churning chimneys of disposal and waste management. The break room is a pokey, sterile place with a handful of uncomfortable faux leather seats, a small coffee table, a cheap refrigerator, sink, handful of never-used cupboards, and a coffee machine. Regardless of how advanced a society manages to become, it seems humankind will forever fail to master the art of cleaning up one's own mess. The sink is full of dirty teaspoons, festering in a slick and mottled lagoon of unpleasant sink water 2 inches deep. Without thinking about it, H moves to the coffee machine and hits the button for a black coffee. A disposable, fully recyclable cardboard cup plops into the serving tray and the machine issues its sputtering hiss as it dispenses the beverage. H hardly notices. His mind is full of what-ifs and should-I's in relation to the incident. A dead body, H thinks. Died in my workstation. The occurrence has set his mind at odds with itself. It takes 16 minutes before the disinfecting of his workstation is complete. It is amazing how quickly time can fly when overthinking. The strong, bitter coffee which H, on autopilot, has drank quickly, now fuels the sense of looming overwhelm. As the huge steel doors to the break room slide open, beckoning H to work, he regrets having drank the stuff. His chest feels even tighter, and a helium-like lightheadedness washes over him. Outside his workstation, H dutifully leans forward towards another retinal scanner, this one embedded into the wall. The machines run their analysis, ascertain his identity. An LED in the wall panel pings bright green. On another keypad below the retinal scanner, H types in his CIC code, antler_sunset_wicker, and then he hits enter. The LED flashes an alarming red and utters a nasty, high-pitched greep. He must have made an error. He has a second go and gets the same result. The caffeine is making his fingers jitter. His mouth feels dry. H curses himself. Now the LED is pulsing a relentless neon orange. One chance left before he is locked out of the workstation. That was the last thing he needed, for it would mean alerting the supervisor. He would be put through a capability check, and it wasn't even 9 a.m. With his heart a jackhammer, his forefinger dithering, H wills himself to calm. He focuses very carefully on entering his CIC. He presses enter The panel issues a much more pleasant chiming tone. The LED turns green, and with a heavy hydraulic hum, the door to his workstation opens. Although the workstation is divided into three rooms, the main working zone, the privacy cubicle, and the send unit, H experiences this place as a matter of patterns and habit, just like he does at the start of every shift. Standing over the metal basin in the privacy cubicle, he turns on the cold tap. This room smells of pungent industrial cleaning fluids, damp and stale urine. He dabs water onto his face. He hopes the cooling liquid will steady the caffeine rush inside, which is trying to set alight his already overly frayed nerves. He looks up into the small grubby mirror above which the phrase, "You're staring at success," is printed, and he notes the features of his face. His is the face of a young-looking 70-year-old, or an old-looking 50-something. H doesn't know which. The craggy lines of his forehead and the road mapping around his tired eyes are not laughter lines, just the etchings of a life of grind. His eyes are watery, but striking in their pale blueness. "One time, long ago," he thinks, "my eyes were attractive." He considers the whitish stubble and decides that later he must shave. He fears his facial hair is probably unkempt enough to trigger a dress code violation query, should anyone look closely enough. This routine of self-inspection occurs every time he clocks on. This is not for vanity's sake, more just for fascinated bemusement. This is my face. The reflection staring back should be a quintessential part of his identity, and yet he doesn't recognise himself. Take, for instance, the blemish under his right eye. Just a small, purplish smudge. It's a birthmark or scar, perhaps. H often ponders that mark. He thinks it's the kind of mark that the bearer in childhood might have worn heavily, for it might have caused embarrassment or led to hurtful comments from other children. But it could also be the kind of unique flaw that brings, from a mother, outpourings of love. "Don't worry about that little speck, my darling. It's just a marker from heaven. It reminds me how lucky I am to have such a beautiful little boy." But H remembers neither cruel comments from other kids, nor a mother's love. He can't recall any memories from his childhood. After drying his hands, H leaves the privacy cubicle and closes the door behind him. He ambles across the main work zone to the send unit and keys in a 6-digit code to unseal the door to the antechamber, where any product that needs sending to a different department can be taken care of. Here, there is an aperture, centre left, in the far wall that will transport anything placed into it to some other distant part of Factory 6, or even further afield. Anything dumped into the right-hand aperture will be spirited away on a one-way fast-track ride to disposal and waste management. Having unlocked the send unit, H prepares for the start of his shift in the main room, a 3x3 squared metre space of cold concrete. To the right of the vast entryway sits a forlorn and cheap-looking steel chair where a worker can momentarily take the weight off if they felt such an urge, which they rarely did. Next to the chair is a refreshment table atop which sits a tower of disposable paper cups, a water dispenser, and a plate of complimentary cookies. Workers are allowed to indulge in the refreshments as much as they like, but it is generally avoided. Pausing long enough to eat a cookie and rehydrate would result in a quarter's quota target being missed, which would trigger a productivity warning. Besides, refreshment station usage was monitored. Duration of privacy cubicle usage was monitored too. Everything was monitored. H shuffles over to the workers' terminal, a tablet computer monitor on an extendable stalk, and enters another access code. Next to the terminal, directly opposite the workstation door, is the portal. After H's code is verified, the concrete walls part to reveal a 1.8 by 1.8 meter opening through which employees are granted direct access to one of the company's innumerable product conveyor belts. H looks at it now. Above the belt, in monolithic red letters, is a banner that displays the motto of the company. Forever's whenever. Everything always. Facing the conveyor, H leans to his left and pulls the worker's terminal towards him so it is positioned as if floating a foot or so from his shoulder. He doesn't need to look to do this. It's muscle memory. He hits a button on the monitor screen, and with an eerily quiet hydraulic hiss, above him, beneath the gaudy banner, the belt starts moving. H imagines the conveyor as if it's a tiny artery interweaving and running alongside myriad others, just one tiny part of an incomprehensibly massive circulatory system. Somewhere deeper, closer to the heart, in places H will never see or visit, products in cardboard packages start being funneled, pumped forth like blood. Millions of parcels all working their way along interconnecting arteries and veins. Within moments, as H stands looking wearily up at the conveyor above, the first parcel glides into view, immediately followed by the second, and then the third. Some of the packages are large, some are small. Most are of a standard geometric shape, cube and cuboid being most prolific, but there are unusually shaped packages too. And on they will go, an endless, indifferent procession. Through a combination of product surveillance and algorithmic decision-making, at some point, approximately every 90 seconds, a parcel is designated for inspection in PPD_6G4, station 005.1.2, by worker CIC code ASW35. It happens now. A bell buzzes, unnecessarily loud given the confined space. An arm in the wall of the main conveyor belt, like a large flipper paddle in a pinball machine, activates. It pushes the chosen box off the belt and onto a roller slide down which the package slips before being deposited onto the inspection plate directly in front of H. The plate is pressure sensitive. As soon as it is depressed by any mass equal to or greater than 0.25 kilograms, the concrete workstation becomes bathed in a soft green light. Now, H is truly on the clock. He gets to it. The box before him is approximately 9 centimeters cubed. H lifts it up and checks its edges and sides. He looks for any indentations, signs of buckling or wear and tear. This package shows no such signs. Deftly, and without taking his eyes from the parcel, H enters some details onto the touchscreen of the worker's terminal. Using a small handheld scanner that rests beside the inspection plate, he scans the container barcode and makes sure the dimensions and weight match the information that appears on the computer. All fine. H scrutinizes the numerous labels attached to the cardboard. Are they neatly and correctly positioned as per company guidelines? Are they affixed firmly? Is all numbering and lettering clear and printed in the appropriate font? New speak sans serif. Next, with a deftness honed over decades, H carefully opens the box. He looks for one of four cavity stuffing fillers, biodegradable bubble wrap, shredded paper, egg box framing, or soft card tubing. If the incorrect stuffing has been used inside the parcel, then it will have to be returned via the send unit to the folk in package and prep. This parcel's info matches the type of filler, and it fills the box to approximately 80%, which is in line with company standards, so H can carry on. He pulls out a handful of shredded paper filling and reveals an egg-shaped device with a USB charging slot. This corresponds correctly with the contents information he pulled from the barcode. Finally, after entering some final details, he places the box on the rollers to the right of the inspection plate, then hits complete on the worker's terminal. The return rollers start moving. The package begins to climb the gradual ascent. It serves as a kind of mechanical slip road at the top of which the recently scrutinised parcel rejoins the ceaseless rush-hour traffic of the main conveyor belt. No sooner has the small package vanished from sight into the unseen depths of Factory 6, the bell rings again, and the next item for inspection is rolling down towards H. For the next 3.5 hours, H simply repeats this process. The automaton-like monotony of his graft gradually lulls his mind away from the unfortunate event that occurred prior to the start of his shift. Inspect parcel, input inspection data, reseal parcel, repeat. His hands and arms move, as if by themselves. His fingers trace and explore and unfold. His eyes look for neatness and precision, straight lines and edges. The soft pad-pad-pad of his fingertips on the worker's terminal screen becomes almost hourly hypnotic. The mindless repetition soothes his nerves and distracts him from unpleasant thoughts. A man died in this room. The mindless repetition is what he knows, all he has ever known. It means he is working, has work, is employed. He has a job. This makes him very lucky. It really is a position of privilege in this day and age. The shrill bell rings, the flipper nudges. He is employed. And forever's whenever, and everything is always. It's a good morning stint. Only 2 packages need to go to the send unit, the first because of severe crumpling along one side, the second because the jumbo box of mixed herbs inside the parcel did not correspond with the barcoded information that suggested the item should have been a toy for a cat. H watches the parcels pass by. Endless. Innumerable. They glide along with the incessant whir of the conveyor belt and it becomes trance-like. Momentarily, H stands and simply is. For whatever reason, a system glitch or perhaps a mechanical malfunction, it has been 3 minutes since the last parcel hit the inspection plate. This does happen from time to time, and on occasion allows H to temporarily drift off into a kind of daydream-like state. This is as close as he ever comes to contentedness. In moments such as these, the pains of his graft, the ache in his feet and tightness in his lower back, which are as familiar to him as the weight of cuffs on the career criminal's wrists, they no longer bother him. His mind wanders to the co-workers with whom he usually shares his break times, old Miguel and Patty, who sometimes prefers to be called Miranda, and occasionally Geraldine. He'll see them soon in the break room. Had they heard about the chap that died? If they had, he was certain they wouldn't know that it had occurred in his workstation. For once, they'd have something of importance to talk about. The bell buzzes, snapping H out of his reverie. The flipper pushes a box from the conveyor belt and it slides down the roller ramp. With a considerable thud, it lands on the inspection plate. Heavy-ish, H concludes. It is 16 by 18 by 12 inches. All edges, sides and surfaces are in good condition. H scans the barcode and enters some details into the terminal, indicating that the dimensions match the barcode. The contents are identified as Easter Island Head Garden Statuettes times 2, which he will verify shortly. He gently prises open the lid of the box and considers the stuffing level and finds it well filled. Because the item is fairly costly, the soft card tubing is also the appropriate choice of filling. H enters these findings onto the terminal and then carefully pushes aside the filler to reveal the parcel's contents. There are no Easter Island Head Garden statuettes inside. In this parcel, there are 2 severed human feet. H shrieks. In the confined space, the shrillness of the sound rebounds at him. Recoiling backwards, he trips over his own heels and then falls. The concrete floor punches the air out of him and he grunts heavily. He barely notices the pain of the fall or the pounding of his heart. He stares at the box on the inspection plate and tries to blink away a warm sense of dizziness that temporarily grays his vision. The workstation, bathed in green light, seems to swim, and H fights to control his breathing, fights to try and calm his racing pulse. His eyes never leave the parcel that malevolently sits but a meter or two away, its lid lolling open with its grisly contents within. 2 severed human feet. Before he had fallen, H had dropped the gruesome items back into the box, but his mind can't stop recalling the gore of the sight, the bone, the cartilage, the way the old, cold skin looked torn as if having been violently hacked at, the way they had felt. Stop, he says H, urging his mind to cease the visuals. Breathe. He scowls at the inspection plate, at that which ominously sits atop it. He shakes his head. It can't be real, he mutters. You've got something wrong. Maybe it was the earlier shock of the fellow dying in his workstation, seeing the medics moving the body. It had just knocked his senses off kilter. Perfectly understandable. Irrational visions. That was it. There are no feet in the box. H shakily picks himself up from the floor. The creaky stiffness of his joints is nullified by the adrenaline coursing through him. Cautiously, he approaches the parcel. Keeping it at arm's length, he reaches for it again. With the tips of his spindly fingers, he parts the lid once more, slowly cranes his angular body forward to peer at that which waits inside. As if taking a blast from a cattle prod, he recoils again, because there is no mistaking the contents, laying at odd angles in the bed of tubular card filler. Dismembered at the lower ankle are 2 human feet. There is bone, ligament and tendon. There is the pinkish redness of the meat. There are blobs of congealed blood. Having to steady himself against the inspection plate, H feels very faint. His pulse beats so thunderously in his temples that he sees a throbbing in the grey static at the periphery of his vision. But then his training kicks in. This is the company. There is policy, protocol and procedure for every possible situation. Everything always. It is a huge relief. Turning his back on the gruesome discovery, H focuses on the workers' terminal. He touches the screen a number of times and then presses enter. The screen asks him if he is sure. He clicks yes and triggers an emergency alert. The soft green light of the workstation is immediately replaced with a pulsing neon yellow light of warning. It will pulse until the supervisor arrives. To complement the sudden shift in lighting, the conveyor belt comes to an immediate halt. From the vast machinery and mechanisms beyond the portal, a deep, shuddering groan is uttered. Once it quietens, from somewhere unseen, a low electronic beeping sound begins. H sits at the refreshment station and pours himself a glass of water. It was a second unscheduled break in a shift only a few hours old. Unheard of. For H, the surreal occurrences of the morning, as well as the proximity to badly mutilated body parts, manifests in a disquieting sense of disembodiment, a weightlessness. H's hand is shaking and he finds it difficult to raise the glass of water to his lips. Breathe, he reiterates. The massive doors of his workstation open with a deep, whispering mumble. A huge man with a head like a concrete block enters. He is the supervisor, and the energy of his inherent aggression seems alarmingly close to the surface, as if just one wrong word away. He doesn't look at H, the subordinate. He looks only at the tablet computer in his gigantic palm. In his meaty hand, the device looks like a small toy. With a deftness that is surprising, given the Neanderthal mass of the appendages, the supervisor's fingers dance over the screen as he types. PPD_6, G4, Station 005.1.2, emergency alarm issued at 11:27 a.m. by... He lifts his massive head and with a focus like a precision engineer laser, casts his gaze upon the ashen face of the scrawny man sat at the refreshment table.
ASW-35,
H croaks. The supervisor looks back to his tablet, much to H's relief.
L1_pinnacle_4.H in attendance,
the huge man declares. The tablet is recording everything. What is the problem? ASW_35. H clears his throat. He feels frightened and intimidated. All of the supervisors were in one way or another menacing. However, triggering the emergency alert was the right choice. He can't have contravened any company policy or guidelines because there are a pair of severed feet in that package. Please, H stutters, unsure of how to explain. He raises his hand and points.
Check the box.
The supervisor's feet pound heavily against the hard floor as he strides towards the inspection plate. He's about to look into the package when a terrible realization hits H.
They must be novelty items for fancy dress or prosthetic effects for a gory film.
The supervisor reaches into the box. Then, without hesitation or emotion, his massive hand re-emerges. It clutches one of the feet. If that is a novelty item, then it is horribly lifelike, H notes to himself. He finds himself deathly tense, awaiting the supervisor's reaction. Holding the gruesome item, there is no trepidation or recoil from the giant man. And is that a hint of bemusement passing over his stoic face? H's heart sinks. The unruffled reaction from the supervisor means H must have made a mistake. They surely aren't real feet. After all, there was no way anyone could physically handle genuine mutilated body parts like that and react so passively. The supervisor, as if he's come to a decision, unceremoniously tosses the foot back onto the inspection plate. It lands with a heavy plop and topples onto its side. H observes the way the flesh slightly wobbles and he feels himself physically pale. Nimble-fingered, the supervisor is tapping away at his tablet computer again. He turns back to the cardboard box and scans the barcode, scrutinizes the information that is thrown back by the system. A heavy scowl etches its way across his brow like thunder clouds over a dark horizon. He looks directly at H for a moment, and then, with a grunt, he wheels around and grabs the foot once more. He shakes it, points it accusingly at H. With the vigour of the action, a piece of gristle is dislodged from the point of severing. It falls onto the webbing between the supervisor's thumb and forefinger and sits there like a grisly token. The big man seems to know nothing about it. Using the foot as a pointing device, he gestures at H.
ASW-35. He grumbles. Explain to me why you call for emergency assistance.
H is dumbfounded. He feels dizzy and is unable to pull his focus from that small gelatinous knot on the overseer's hand. His heart hammers erratically as if providing a percussive interpretation of the madness of the moment. His vision blurs like someone has temporarily pulled a sheet of cling film over his face.
The foot...
He hears himself murmur. The supervisor's scowl deepens. He gives the lopped-off limb a cursory glance before slowly turning around and replacing it back in the box. This comes as a huge relief to H. The supervisor is once more tapping at the tablet, all the while the yellow, pulsing light in which the workstation swims adds to the unreality of the situation. H tries to take a deep breath, but he feels nauseous.
The human feet!
He moans, his voice sounding weak and disconnected. The supervisor offers an overtly frustrated sigh and stops tapping on the tablet.
What is all this talk of feet?
H is slack-jawed, silent in his bewilderment. He doesn't know what to say. Is this some sort of prank? He thinks.
ASW_35. This package is in excellent condition with the appropriate stuffing filled to the right level within the container. The dimensions perfectly match the barcode specification and the items inside,
he points aggressively at the box. The lump of ankle meat is thrown from his hand and lands on the inspection plate.
Ah, as detailed accurately by the system... A pair of decorative garden statuettes shaped like the stone heads of Easter Island.
A sharp jab of pain skewers H through his ribcage as he tries to comprehend this. He clutches his chest, shakes his head.
No,
he quietly declares. That can't be.
This package meets all standards as recommended by the company for acceptable PPD quality control. There is nothing wrong here other than your choice to impose unnecessary delays on the customer by triggering an inappropriate emergency assistance alarm. Not only have you wasted my time, but you also fail to comply with standard operating policy, primarily the 3 before we see protocol. Yeah? Did you forget about that? You are hereby issued with a grade C infringement warning and will be docked 1 hour's pay.
H's mind whirls. He hears the supervisor's words but is unable to process what is happening.
The package in question, the supervisor continues with the tone of a drill sergeant, is now part of an infringement report and must therefore be sent upstairs. And
can you do that, please?
H interrupts. What? The supervisor blurts, looking as though he is considering just kicking this subordinate in the chest with all his might.
Could you send the package upstairs, please? I don't feel too well.
And H certainly doesn't look too well. This seems to pacify the line manager. He acquiesces with a grunt. He turns on his heel, puts the box under one arm, and then marches towards the send unit. H watches him. A moment later, he hears the quiet whoosh as the offending package is sent away upstairs. Where and what upstairs is, H doesn't care to think about. The package is gone. And that is beyond a huge relief. The supervisor re-emerges into the main room, decisively tapping at his tablet. A moment later, the yellow emergency lights stop pulsing and become orange, the colour of a productivity warning. As you can see, ASW_35, you are now below quota for the shift. You must work hard to catch up or risk receiving a grade B infringement warning. Do not let this happen again. He strides towards the door, but before releasing the locking mechanism, as if struck by an afterthought, he turns back. When he speaks, his tone is somewhat softer and all the less sincere for it. Given the unfortunate incident at the start of your shift, given that it could have impaired your judgment, I saw fit only to dock you 1 hour's pay. Think yourself lucky. This kind of protocol breach could warrant a much more severe penalty. Suddenly exhausted, H nods limply.
Thank you, I'm very grateful.
I went easy on you, because at the company, your well-being is a top priority. Everything always.
Everything always.
H echoes.
Patty listens so very little but speaks so very much. Whenever she isn't speaking, she is chuckling, for she is inexplicably joyous. H doesn't know where she finds the optimism, but he admires her for it. Drowning in company overalls that swamp her skeletal frame, she is a nervous, shrewish woman. As per company policy, her hair is tied back, and severely so. H can make out the redness of her scalp beneath the thin, mousy brown hair. She picks up a monologue that she started at some point in the past, regardless of whether anyone was listening or not.
And the best thing about air plants is that they don't need any water, because with water tokens being so expensive, I can't afford to be watering plants every day. They'd just die off, and oh, I couldn't have that. It would make me very sad.
Her words are emphasised by pointed gesticulations and taut facial expressions that border on physical tics.
So the air plants, and oh, they brighten up the place a treat. They only need a good dunking in water once a year. They're wonderful things, they really are. I think that everybody would benefit from having at least a couple of air plants, and given that they're not that particularly expensive, you just want to keep one or two.
His grimly dramatic morning is playing hell with his senses. He sits numbly. His mind is an incomprehensible blur of piecemeal thoughts and broken ideas. Old Miguel is sat sunken into the faux leather sofa. Where the seat ends and the man begins is tough to identify. The faded umber of the upholstery is a perfect match to the man's tired tan. H thinks that he must have roots in Spain or Mexico. It is inconceivable that there isn't some kind of Latin heritage in his blood. H had tried on more than one occasion to inquire about his friend's ethnicity, but the answer was always the same.
I don't remember.
Whether all Miguel is listening to Patty or not is debatable. He is scrolling, as he does every break, through videos of yesteryear on his phone that perches atop his considerable paunch. His eyes are glassy. His focus neither here nor there.
Because they need livening up, don't they?
Patty asks nobody in particular.
And on our wages, we have such limited options in terms of home decor, don't we? I mean,
it's not as if we can just wonder... In which he always sits. It is uncomfortable and keeps his spine unnaturally rigid. Incessantly, his legs tap. His forefinger is woodpeckering against his thumb. He wants counsel and solace from his colleagues, but doesn't know how to raise the issue, or if he should raise it at all. The supervisor's response, or lack of one, to the foot is a staggering conundrum. It was as if he just hadn't seen the severed body part at all. Now H dreads a similar response from Patty and old Miguel.
Because Ingrid is so good at illustration, Patty explains. She saved her wages for an awful long time. I don't know how she was able to do it and feed herself at the same time. And eventually, after months of saving, she bought a pack of pencils. She uses them to draw the most fantastic pictures. She hangs them on the wall. She wants to sell them, but it's against company policy. They'd fire her if they found out she was selling her own things. But still, just imagine.
Patty takes a rare pause for breath and enjoys a moment of reverie, fantasizing about earning a living outside of the company. She feels a sense of muted excitement, but the idea is so foreign a notion that it is impossible to clearly contemplate.
I think there was a pair of feet in a package I inspected,
H mutters.
Either that or I imagined it.
I don't have artist hands like Ingrid,
Patty explains with a sigh and a chuckle.
My hands are only good for unpack, inspect, repack and unpack again.
Have you ever heard of such a thing?
H asks. Old Miguel doesn't respond. He seems riveted to a rather ancient-looking 4K piece of video footage from the British Civil War of 2031.
I told Ingrid that she should just go for it. Try and sell her art. Try to get out.
Patty's voice is hushed with a cheeky conspiratorial tone.
I don't ever let the supervisors hear me talking that way. Goodness, no.
Two severed human feet in a box,
H blurts, his voice a little shrill. Old Miguel glances towards him.
The supervisor picked it up, waved it around. It was as if he didn't see what I saw. He said they were garden statues, just as the barcode suggested. But if there weren't feet in there, then that means that I'm the real problem.
Old Miguel interrupts with his voice deep and sincere.
Is that the unions don't exist anymore.
He looks blankly at his colleague.
Doesn't matter what we're up against.
Old Miguel continues.
Inflation goes up as regularly as the hands on a clock turn. Workload exponentially increases. Workplace bullying is rife and borders on assault.
At this, H recalls a supervisor staring at him as if ready to lash out.
When they legalized the unions and took away the right to strike, they pulled out our teeth. They completely removed our power to fight back. So whether it's body parts in packages or being sacked for selling one's own artwork, there's nothing that can be done.
Ingrid could really make a go of it, I think,
says Patty, dreamily.
Imagine leaving the company.
Have body parts turned up before then?
H asks.
What does it matter?
Old Miguel mumbles, his eyes already wandering back to his phone screen.
Don't you remember that spate of limb injuries a few years back? Mangled hands, crushed fingers.
H vaguely recalls something that might or might not be relevant. He nods anyway.
Well, the employees that were injured, they were fired for contaminating company equipment.
Oh, I remember that,
bleats Patty with a distressed giggle.
They really do know how to grind you down, eh?
I get it,
H insists.
But if they were actually feet... Perhaps from some unlucky employee further down the production line who was horribly injured, say, then why would the supervisor pretend they weren't feet? What did he do with the package?
Old Miguel asks.
Send unit. Part of an infringement report. Exactly. Out of sight, out of mind. And with you in the crosshairs for some sort of misdemeanor, no doubt. They can get away with anything. Anything. Why does the supervisor lie? Why did the government ban all protests and demonstrations? Why are human body parts being shipped here and there in broad daylight? Why has the archive footage from the Grenfell fire been erased? Why? There are two answers, my friend. One, because it serves to bolster their authority, either through increased conformity or profit. And two, because they can.
All the more reason why Ingrid should take her chances, chimes Patty. You should see her sketches of the Brienne Strasse Brown House. They're incredible.
They can do anything they want, whenever they like,
laments old Miguel as he takes pains to slowly stand up. Both he and the sofa sigh.
Mouths without teeth can't bite, he mutters.
A loud klaxon blares. A bright red light flashes three times. It is time to return to work. With a heavy mechanical hiss, the doors to the break room unlock and grind open. Old Miguel and Patty leave, and as soon as they are beyond the threshold of the break room doors, they are lost to the dark. A rising sense of dread and standing up too quickly result in H almost falling back down onto the chair, but he steadies himself. He looks in the direction of his departed colleagues and realises that he has taken no useful advice from old Miguel or Patty, none at all. Furthermore, he feels an absurd sense of disappointment. He forgot to tell them about the guy that kicked the bucket that morning, in his workstation too. H decides that it is not in his own best interest to fret any more about the feet incident. He'll try to push it out of mind. He just can't afford to cause any more of a stink today because he would be quite literally jeopardising his employment. And employment is privilege, work is freedom. He should be grateful. Besides, he simply can't believe that the supervisor was pretending that he didn't see the feat. This was just too much of a stretch to believe, despite old Miguel's insistence that the powers above can do whatever they want. H was becoming more convinced that it was far more likely that he had suffered some sort of episode. That the shock of seeing the cadaver before starting his shift had manifested in a gory hallucination. That's not unreasonable, is it? H muses as he repacks another item beneath the conveyor belt. Perfectly feasible, given the circumstances. He has pondered this for over an hour since break, and the more he works, the more he convinces himself that any kind of episode is actually all right, nothing to worry about. After seeing the body first thing, that the strong coffee had frazzled his senses. That's it. My mind is just on edge. It was an hallucination. Relief, or some semblance thereof, begins to settle into him as the shift wears on. He isn't mad. He just had a nasty shock. That's all. The bell rings. A rectangular box, the size of a large book, is deposited onto the inspection plate. The workstation lights flick to that neon amber. He still hasn't worked off the productivity deficit yet. And when H gets around to opening the package, he finds himself racked by a paroxysm of dismay and terrible shock as if he'd been hit by a taser. The box contains a severed human hand. H staggers backwards, and his heartbeat becomes an arrhythmic frenzy that makes him feel simultaneously sick and faint. But at least he doesn't fall this time. He bends over at the waist, hands on hips, takes a number of deep in-breaths. Steadies his nerves. He's startled by how much less shocking this second occurrence is than the first. How quickly we can acclimatise to the most dire of circumstances, he thinks. He knows that he cannot, must not, hit the emergency stop again. The supervisor has established himself as a hostile combatant in this conundrum. H considers entering the product as defective on the terminal before immediately incinerating it out of sight, out of mind, and yet within him there grows a more and more insistent impetus. Something very wrong is happening here and I need to know what it is. H decides he needs another opinion on whether or not there really is a human hand in the box. The three before we see policy was propagandized to the workforce as a way of bringing about organic upskilling for employees, making them more eligible for reward or promotion. In reality, it was a system that further distanced the management class from the workers at the coalface. The we see aspect of the policy,
when someone from supervisor level or above has to directly respond to an ongoing issue, very quickly became synonymous with punishment. Employees that activated We See were invariably penalised for ignorance, for time-wasting, for anti-company subversions, or malevolent misuse of company policy, whatever they saw fit at the time. It soon came to pass that absolutely nobody wanted management to see at all, regardless of the severity of the issue. Averting his eyes from the lifeless hand nestled inside the box, H scans the package's barcode, moves to the worker's terminal, and presses a button labelled 3B4. This plunges the workstation into a deep purple glow, which gives the space a subaqueous claustrophobic radiance. The worker's terminal tells H that a product inquiry is launching. Next, he is asked about the nature of the issue. He scrolls through a drop-down menu that offers no option befitting of body part in package. The closest choice he can find is package contamination. He presses it. From a console in the work portal wall, a sensor module emerges. It is on a fully mobile telescopic rubber stalk. A diaphanous white light is emitted from the sensor module, which then begins to pass over the box and the grisly hacked-off hand no fewer than 3 times, up and down and then side to side. The bright white light vanishes with a soft click. Then the sensor module vanishes back into the recess in the portal wall. A moment later, the worker's terminal offers a bleep. The analysis is displayed on the screen. H paws over it. Package quality. Excellent. Package dimensions. Accurate. Labelling. Excellent. Filler. Appropriate. Very good. It is the last piece of information that H is most concerned with. Package contents. Times 1 self-help book. Overcoming chronic consumerism. The tightening in H's chest re-emerges. The lightheadedness urges him to just sit down for a while. He clenches his jaw when the worker's terminal asks, "Did this resolve your issue?" He jabs, "No." H initiates stage 2 of 3 before we see, and waits while the terminal accesses and opens up the workers' chatboards and database, the enormous employee forums. This is where the knowledge of a million workers, their expertise and experiences are readily accessible to offer you a range of problem-solving strategies. At least, that's how the company sells the database to its bemused staff. In reality, it's just terabytes and terabytes of angry rants from desperate employees. H is offered a screen where the top trending issues can be immediately accessed. Currently, the top 3 are as follows. 1. Post-work headaches won't go away. 16,732 comments. 2. Colleagues vanished, WTAF, 15,205 comments. 3. Executive board is AI, CEO in algorithm only, 13,967 comments. When the employee forums were first launched, there was much talk of it being just another way to monitor what workers were saying to one another. But after weeks turned to months and months turned to years, and as the content of what was posted there became more and more inane and flagrant, and, in response, nothing happened, it became commonly accepted that management weren't watching the chatboards after all. It was as if they didn't care what the workers were saying, regardless of how incendiary the idea. It was as though, no matter the level of vitriol, such voices were but whispers in the wind. They didn't matter. It makes H think of what old Miguel said. Mouths without teeth can't bite. Believing that management weren't monitoring the forums means that H enters his query without worry. Body parts in parcels, he types, then hits enter. The console whirs and considers for a moment and then blinks an affirmative response. 6,743 forum threads pertaining to body parts in parcels. Halfway down the first page of results, one particular post title leaps out. Either I'm losing my mind, or there is a fucking foot in this package. H blinks in astonishment. His pulse pounds. It has happened before. He's onto something.
He opens the post and begins to read avidly.
Who is there to tell? Is that the biggest part of this clusterfuck of a problem? Even when faced with the most dire of concerns, life and death concerns, there is nobody to whom we can turn. How did it come to this? There is either a human foot in this parcel, it looks like a woman's given the size, or I am delusional. The box should apparently contain a smart collar and leash for monitoring a dog's health and fitness levels, but I don't see a doggy exercise kit. I see a gruesomely severed human foot. If it really is a foot, then it means that somewhere out there is a poor woman with a really awful injury, one she might not have survived. It could have been an awful accident, or maybe a terrible crime. Isn't it my obligation to respond appropriately? Inform the necessary authorities? However, if I am hallucinating this foot, then am I not, therefore, comprehensively mad? If the latter is true, then surely there must be an appropriate channel to allow me to seek immediate psychiatric support. Whatever the truth, I can't tell anyone about this. Only peril lies in seeking support. I wanted to alert my supervisor without directly alerting him, so to speak, so I feigned a workstation fault. With the broom handle and a deft hand, you can bring the parcel guidance arm to a halt so no packages can be pushed onto your inspection plate. I'd occasionally use this tactic to get an extra minute or two of break. Once a couple of parcels had built up, I'd correct the guidance arm error and release the parcels, but not this time. This time I jammed the arm and hit the emergency alert. I left the parcel containing the foot by the door, its grim contents clearly on display. When the supervisor thundered into my station, he didn't notice the package at first. He just made an angry beeline for me, itching to slap an infringement notice on me. However, when he saw the jammed conveyor belt, he accepted that it had been an appropriate use of the emergency alert. He seemed disappointed not to be able to penalise me. He fixed the malfunction, turned, and headed for the door. He was glued to his tablet computer, and with dread I thought he was going to miss the parcel, but then he glanced up, looked at the open box, the heinously dismembered limb sticking out of it, and without missing a stride, just said, "Sort that out. The company operates a zero-clutter policy, yes?" Sort that out? There's a fucking human foot on the floor as plain as day, and that's all he says. It was like he didn't see it or didn't recognise it, which was an impossibility. It is most likely then that I am mad. The supervisor saw the truth. No foot, just a bloody smart collar for your border collie. He wasn't horrified by the foot because there was no foot. To me, there was a foot because I've gone utterly crazy. And is that so hard to imagine? I've forgotten my own name. I can only estimate my age based on the stiffness in my bones, by the darkening of the frown lines in my brow, by the rasp of my ceaseless cough. I can't remember the last time I talked to another human being other than the supervisor barking orders at me. There are no other co-workers in my break room anymore, which is strange because I know there were colleagues who shared their break with me at one time or another. But when I try to recall them, I can only bring to mind the image of two young children. I don't know who these kids are supposed to be or where the memory is from. Is it a fragment from my long ago forgotten youth? I have no direct memories of my childhood. We are all born. We all grow up and experience a childhood, right? But I can't recall any of it. The company is all I know, and that I should be grateful to them for giving me employment. Reader, I wonder if you have childhood memories. Although, I wonder, who are you? Will anyone ever read this? If there is nobody listening, then why do I bother telling? What's the difference if I say nothing at all, or whether I explain that there are human body parts slowly passing through the immeasurable depths of this place like specks of undigested food in the gargantuan guts of some unimaginably gigantic behemoth,
and that these specks just pass through the way the partially heard shrieks materialise in my terrible dreams, the nightmares that I experience every single...
H shuts off the post as hurriedly as he can. He can't close down the employee forums quick enough, and as soon as the screen vanishes, a prompt is offered.
Has this resolved your issue?
H clicks no. His heart rabbit races as he struggles with the idea that someone else once experienced a situation very similar to his, and that individual seemed to have completely lost the plot. Despite the shock of the forum post, H's plan is still actually working. He just wants a second set of eyes on the mutilated hand in the box, and not the eyes of anyone in management. Stage 3, the last action that can be taken before we see, is the colleague referral. He had decided that he would call on Patty to attend the scene. She was so entirely plugged into the superfluous surface level of reality that H believed she would only be able to react to the contents of the box instinctively and honestly. If she saw a severed hand, then her reaction would show it. She was far more likely to call a spade than old Miguel, who was too prone to lapse into the symbolic and metaphorical. So it is Patty that he decides upon. But before he can reach out for her, the system throws up an alternative option.
You recently accessed forum post. Either I'm losing my mind or there is a fucking foot in this package. Would you like to request support from the writer of this post?
It hits H like the proverbial light bulb. To speak directly with the person that had experienced the exact same issue as him. The feelings of helplessness, the concerns about going crazy. H clicks yes.
Terabytes and terabytes of digital reference points are scanned, relevant data collated, the system buffers.
A warm wave of dizziness washes over H. He reaches for the inspection plate to steady himself. The system throws up a message.
Error.
H presses details, whilst cursing the fact that in the company, there was a protocol for everything, but never a solution. The screen changes. H reads the miserable news. The author of the post died 12 years ago. It turns out that Patty is unavailable due to currently being under investigation for a Grade B infringement report. That is why now, old Miguel is in H's workstation, holding the severed hand with a curious reverence. H watches on from his seat at the refreshment station. He had needed to sit down. He feels as though he could, at any moment, pass out from the anxiety. He desperately hopes that his colleague will validate him, that human body parts are turning up in packages. Then the two of them would be able to come up with a plan.
You call it a hand,
old Miguel eventually croons.
The label calls it a self-help book. They will call it a productivity warning. So, what does it matter what I call it?
It matters to me, Miguel,
H breathily exclaims.
Because if it is a human hand, then some crime or an awful accident has occurred, and I want to do the right thing. Is that so bad? And if it is a fucking self-help book that you're holding, then I am hallucinating chopped off limbs, aren't I? Which would mean I've gone stark raving mad. I'm asking for help.
Old Miguel looks at the hand a little longer, and then chuckles.
Listen,
he begins, his voice a mixture of avuncular charm and condescension.
You are just part of a system. The question is, do you have the power to change that system? If you do, then you could draw the attention of all the eyes that matter to this problem of yours. But you don't have that kind of power. You talk of doing the right thing, but to the company, whatever you choose to do is akin to doing nothing at all. We have power only over ourselves. To make decisions about our own actions. So, whistleblow, raise the alarm. Or don't. Forget the issue and go back to work. Or fixate on it and down tools. Whatever you choose, it'll only affect you. The machine inside which you are but a tiny morsel won't be affected at all by what you choose. But you can't pass the buck. You can't make this anybody else's issue. It's your issue and yours alone. Make your choice and then move on. You say this is a human hand. I say that it's nothing more than a manufacturing error.
The belittlement, the arrogance. Old Miguel is a pompous ass. H is on his feet, despite the whirling lightheadedness.
How can you be so blasé?
He spits.
Would you be so cold and calculating if these body parts belonged to someone in your family, to one of your children?
He glares at old Miguel. Part of him wants to kick and scream. Another part wants to weep.
How on earth could it be a body part belonging to someone in my family?
Old Miguel asks blandly.
That's impossible. How is it impossible? Because it's not a body part. It's a manufacturing error.
As he walks towards the workstation exit, he mutters a final thought.
Haven't you been listening?
The first question is one of old Miguel's motive. Why had he chosen to be so obtuse? It seemed cruel. And if he had seen the human hand, then his behaviour was more than cruel. It was deranged. That leads to H's second question. Had his colleague seen a hand or not? Old Miguel had concluded that the item was a manufacturing error, which was an absurdity of the highest order, unless his colleague had lost his marbles too. Contagious craziness in the company. The idea didn't seem that far-fetched. The third question torments him most, dragging him down like some malevolent emotional anchor. Am I losing my mind? Or am I already mad? He recalls glancing at the manufacturing error as it was clutched in old Miguel's hand, the co-worker reaching his ludicrous conclusions. H had definitely seen the unpleasant pinkish colour of the meat and the severed bone, dull white with a marrow-darkened centre. What he saw was undoubtedly a human hand. Old Miguel's ability to seemingly dismiss the truth by some haphazard relabeling was a real shock to H. Were one of his own limbs ever to mysteriously turn up in a cardboard parcel on someone else's inspection plate, he would hope that the individual in question would take the personal and moral responsibility to at least try to find some sort of resolution, even if it was by just raising the alarm. Which brings H to the fourth burning question. Having exhausted all stages of the three before we see policy, was he going to summon the supervisor again? In the core of his being, he doesn't want to.
I have a job, he mutters. I am employed.
To be unemployed in this day and age was as good as being dead. That's what he was risking if he called the supervisor for a second time in one shift. For years, for decades and longer, all H had ever known were the rituals of the company. The shift pattern, the work rota, the ceaseless back and forth of the workstation, inspect, unpack, repack. This was the rhythm, the very pulse of his existence. So, as his mind hornet buzzes between images of dead colleagues, of early morning ambulances, of severed body parts, of feelings of dread and lunacy and anger, of Patty's rambling and old Miguel's frustrating abstractions, he does what he knows best. He inspects parcels, unpacks them, enters details into the terminal, repacks them. Because he has spent too much time in flustering bewilderment at the day's events, now the workstation is bathed in an alarming red light. He is way off his productivity quota for the shift. By altering some settings on the worker's terminal, he can increase the ratio of parcels delivered to his inspection plate. Perhaps, if he works hard and luck is on his side, he might be able to scrape into neutral productivity for the shift. Two neutrals in a week, or three in a month, would trigger a productivity investigation, the docking of 1 hour's pay and a grade C infringement warning. But finishing this awful shift in neutral would be a victory, and a far more positive outcome than leaving the place bathing as it is right now in that ominous crimson red. So he gets to work. Soon, with muscle memory easing him into autopilot, and after several very straightforward package inspections, his nerves ease a little. Before long, all his fret and panic about the day's unpleasant occurrences take on a dreamlike quality, as if they might have never happened. Repetition is anesthetic. Like the innumerable masses working across the huge plethora of zones, compounds, departments, factories and warehouses, H succumbs to the trance-like monotony of being employed. In the company, this is how things have worked for, well,
seemingly forever now, any singular given moment becomes as unimportant and unremarkable as any other. Every moment becomes whenever. But as long as the workers are continuously reminded that they are employed and are ergo not homeless or without food or incarcerated or dead, then the conveyor belts can continue to roll, and out of every orifice products pour like perspiration through the pores of the enormous body that is the company. Products pour out, and the profits roll in. It is the way of the world, and it's always been this way. No? In the oppressive scarlet glow of the station, the bell buzzes. H barely hears it. A medium to large-sized box is nudged off the belt and onto the down ramp, and even before it hits the inspection plate, H knows there is something wrong with it. The cardboard is warped, worn and dog-eared. Its edges are crumpled and buckled in numerous places. It is a long way off meeting the basic packaging standards. The barcode and all other labelling information is obscured beyond visibility by a thick layer of grime. H sees that the card has actually worn through in several patches. He recoils from the package. Not physically, but on a deeper, more primal level. Something about the decaying parcel a foot cubed in size is so incongruous in its decrepitude that it repulses him. The contents of his stomach seem to congeal and turn over. Any solace found in the mind-numbing work vanishes. Dread and panic descend once more. How peculiar it is then that he feels on every level of his being utterly compelled to open the ill-omened box. Before he is able to even begin to try and cognitively square the circle of this unpleasant realization, he is moving forward and reaching out. With a cautious and morbid deference, H uses his shaking thumb to smudge aside the grime that coats the product information label. He clears a whitish patch a couple of inches long and as thick as his thumb. The barcode is revealed. He scans it into the worker's terminal, which immediately throws back the supposed contents. 1x Tibetan singing bowl. H notices the sagging bottom right-hand side of the package. It is considerably more buckled here. It looks weakened, as if damp, even wet. It is darker than the rest of the cardboard. Tentatively, he pinches the area between his thumb and forefinger. It is moist to the touch. When he moves his hand away and looks at his fingertips, he finds them smeared with blood. A wave of dizziness threatens to knock him to his backside. His ribcage seems to tighten. Breathing becomes more difficult. He feels cold.
Run,
a part of him urges.
Hit the emergency. Wait for that lumbering idiot supervisor when the doors open. Barge past him. Just run.
Another part of him seems to agree. It speaks to him with Patty's voice.
Yes! Oh, goodness, if you run, you could get outside and keep going. Find the boundaries of the factory. Scale them. Flee. See what lies beyond this godforsaken place.
Regardless of whether you run or not, you must hit the emergency alert.
Another part of him urges.
There's blood seeping out of that parcel. And don't forget the feet, the hand. Something terribly bad is happening here. Call for help, it's the right thing to do.
H's pulse races, and with each jackhammer, the tightness in his torso increases. He grimaces, struggles for breath. He's almost convinced that he must hit the emergency stop.
But what if it isn't blood? What if the supervisor can't see it or won't see it?
Well, another part of him that sounds like old Miguel declares,
a second infringement in one shift, ranting about body parts in packages. You'll be carted off to the psych infirmary for tests.
It'll be a couple of days off work and...
Oh, wouldn't you just love a couple of days off work, eh?
This part of him is immediately shut down.
No, you shouldn't ever think that way.
H actually mouths the words of the next thought as they come to him. Employment is privilege. Work is freedom. To reinforce this idea, another part of him conspiratorially urges him to action.
Dump the box, then. Label it as terminal defect. Drop it into the incineration hatch. Done. End of story. Finish shift. Go home. Tomorrow is another day. And you will still be employed.
A deeply moral and resolute voice within him calmly comes to the fore.
You must get to the bottom of this. Yes, you are employed, but are you not a human being as well?
H offers a small nod to this notion.
Then what kind of human being do you want to be? Are you an upstanding, decent person? If so, then it's your responsibility to find out what's in that box. It's my problem,
H whispers to himself, old Miguel's words echoing in his head.
Make your choice and then move on.
Something inside him becomes galvanized. Heart racing and combating a singular sense of lightheadedness, H warily moves back towards the inspection plate. With shaking fingers, thin like a bird's bones, he opens the blood-soaked box. His mind works furiously to try and convince him that his fingers have not just clutched a cold, matted and damp handful of hair. It tries to desperately persuade him that the hard, dome-shaped solidity beneath is not that of a human scalp. It could be a sculpture, an artist's dummy. He believes neither of these things. There is an instant right then, when he might have let go. He hadn't seen what he was holding. It was, as yet, still out of sight, out of mind. He could just thrust the thing deep back into the parcel, close a lid, pick up that accursed box and sprint for the send unit, incinerate it. But he doesn't. He can't. Fearing his nerve will break should he delay any longer, with one quick yank he pulls the heavy object from the box and finds himself staring at a decapitated head. H is frozen to the spot. He tries to unclench his fist, but he can't let go. What's more is the morbidly mesmeric pull of the horrendous thing. There is something about it that draws his terrified focus. Then he sees it. Despite the filth and gore, H recognizes the face. It is the head of a young-looking 70-year-old or an old-looking 50-something. The glassy, lifeless eyes are a piercing pale blue that might have once long ago been considered attractive. It can't be. Is he recognizing himself? Is he staring at and with his own hand holding his own decapitated head? When H notices the small purplish smudge beneath the right eye, the kind of blemish that kids might have made cruel remarks about, but that a mother might have once cherished, something in H's chest gives way. A bright white light explodes in his vision, a rolling surge of tremendous pain like a colossal electrical storm contained entirely within his chest bursts through him. He collapses onto the cold concrete floor of the workstation, and before the end takes him, a momentary relief comes in the form of his final thought.
At least I am employed.
Then everything becomes a depthless black. When employee productivity drops to a certain level, the lazy worker in question is warned by the change in workstation lighting. First amber, then, if things get really bad, red. Once in the critical crimson zone, should employee output continue to drop, productivity checks and infringement warnings are automatically enacted and issued respectively. Management involvement is initiated. H's supervisor, L1_pinnacle_4.h, who believes his real name is Mike, or maybe Mark, looks at a window on his tablet screen and sees hundreds of small blips. There are screens and screens of these blips, and he can scroll back and forth through them at his leisure. Tens of thousands of blips. The vast majority are green. Many are orange. A few are red. Then the screen alerts him to one blip that is now a pulsing red. He clicks on it. PPD_6G4Station005.1.2 CICASW_35. The supervisor grunts. 3 minutes later, he unlocks the door to the workstation. ASW35's dead body is on the floor. Next to the corpse, the supervisor notices something.
It seems that before dying, ASW-35 had dropped the contents of a package onto the floor. The supervisor identifies the object immediately. It is a product anomaly. He rolls his eyes. 30 minutes later, station 005.1.2 is being disinfected. Dusk is falling when two medics stretcher the body of ASW-35 out of Gate 4. Nearby, a female worker watches on, concerned. The medics load the stretcher into the back of the vehicle, close the door. A tall, heavily armed security guard approaches her.
BRE-42?
He asks. She nods. The security guard explains something to her about it being her lucky day, that she'll get 15 minutes to relax in the break room before the start of her shift due to some sort of incident in her workstation. As a wave of dizziness washes over her and her chest tightens, she watches the ambulance as it pulls off and purrs away along the southbound road towards the forever churning chimneys of disposal and waste management. Forever's Whenever, Everything Always is an original short horror story written, created and performed by me, Luke Emsley, for this, my podcast, The Dark Beacon. If you want to find out a little bit more about me, the other kind of work that I do, you can catch me on Instagram at LLukeOnce. Very clever, Luke. Thanks, Luke. So clever. I'm going to have to spell that out, aren't I? Yeah, on Instagram, it's LLukeQuence. Brilliant. Thank you ever so much for listening. Ciao.